Some wounds don't show up physically. They're not going to show up on an x-ray or an MRI or anything like that. You can be home doing your job, showing up for your family, and still feel like part of you is stuck in the past. A lot of veterans know what it's like to carry this pain around with them day to day and to feel disconnected and wonder whether life will ever feel the same again. This conversation in this episode brings up some sort of hope as our guest today, Lou Beam Cogan, shares his path from surviving 9/11 to building Wings for Heroes. You're going to hear how this sense of purpose can be rebuilt, how movement can wake something back up inside of you, and how healing can start with one person refusing to look away. There's no sugarcoating in this episode here. We took a real look at grief, at service, trauma, community, and the types of action that helps wounded veterans feel strong again. But before we get into this episode, I want to take a moment to raise awareness for something deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians who are impacted by the Global War on Terrorism. This memorial will be both a tribute to those who've served and a way to ensure that their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you'd like to learn more or find out how you can support their mission, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Now let's get into today's episode. Hey, Lou Beam, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Scott. I actually was waiting for this one a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's been a little while since we first got in touch, and you know, finally here's the day we can actually sit down and have a conversation. Before we kind of jump in conversation, for the listeners who maybe aren't familiar with who you are, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and things like that, just to give the listeners an idea of who we're talking about here?
Right now, I run a humanitarian mission that I started a little more than 2 years ago. It's called Wings for Heroes, and the original idea was to take bad veterans who had amputations and bring them to a peaceful place. And the peaceful place that I found is a beach in Turkey. We have the beach, we have the mountains. The culture is really awesome, you know, people are really great. And I thought, you know, they'd spend some time in quiet because, you know, in some parts of the world, there is no peace and quiet right now, like in Ukraine. And sure. I thought that, you know, my passion, my sport is paragliding. For those who don't know, we go out with this little plastic bag over our head and we have little strings, right? And there is no fuselage and there is no engine. And when I went flying the first time, it really scared me. And like to the point where I was saying goodbye to my dad and my brother in the air, I will never see you again. And I thought that what if too, you know, like people, the psychologists say that you really need that positive traumatic experience that is like immediate and really intense sometimes to come back to life. And I thought, what if we can do this with amputees? Because there is a moment when you go off the cliff, no matter what you're thinking, like your subconscious, your primordial brain takes over and you have no other problems, but you want to live. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. And it doesn't matter that if there is a loss of a limb or something, that it just drives and takes over. And, you know, I thought that would be the whole mission, you know, just bring them, organize, get away, bring them to the beach and let's go flying. Which was really awesome, you know, to do that. That was really, really great. But then I found out that they have other needs. And we added, you know, intense physical therapy. And, well, basically, this is what the mission is doing right now. So I'm answering the question about the end. But to answer the question that you asked me, I cannot hear. I was in the United States in end of November, beginning of December, and I got your book, which is so awesome and it's so inspiring. And I just, you know, I read this and I thought like, wow, this is really something special. And I was in this, I, when they, I, okay, perfect getaway. I immigrated to the United States in 1992. I was 17 and, I got a status. I got an asylum. I came as a refugee. But just a little bit to back up, I was growing up when I was five, the Afghanistan war started. And I grew up in the former Soviet Union. So Afghanistan war started and it lasted until I was 16. So like my whole first part of of my conscious life, it's on the background. And I don't know how old a child needs to be to learn that draft is mandatory, that they take you and they send you. But like consciously, I remember these experiences throughout my life, which were, I think they were really like, in the States, we would classify them as like really traumatic experiences that children don't need to go through by knowing being sure. exposed. And then as I grew up, I was wondering like why things like this happen. And anyways, in 92, I got to move to the United States, and the United States was really generous to me. Like I think I got super lucky because one day, I'm 17 years old, so it's just the way we moved. I'm 17 years old. My dad comes home and he says, we are moving today, tonight. Just pack up your things and, we're not coming back. And it's like, okay. I didn't need hours at that time because I wanted to ski. So I pack up my ski suit, my boots, my helmet, and I was ready to go. And when I came to the States, I asked my uncle to ride to different ski schools and say, I want to go and see if I can ski here. And the National Sports Academy at Lake Placid invited me. It was Halloween of 92. We drove from like New Jersey, North Jersey to upstate New York. It was 300 miles. It was like a day trip. And for me, like seeing America for the first time was just like, wow. I got to see, yeah. We drove the thruway. 87 going all the way north. So you go through Albany, you go through Catskills, then you get to the Adirondacks Park. It's like, wow, really beautiful nature. And I got lucky. I went to school and my classmate's last name was on beer cans. So I am at this super, prestigious, expensive boarding school. And that was my first experience. And, I got a scholarship so I can live there. I can learn English. They feed me, they gave me skis and said, okay, when, you have free time, you can go ski jump as much as you want to. So, that was super, super great. And, like this, America was great to me. Then I got into NYU. I went to school in New York and I always wanted to work in the World Trade Center. I know it's one of the things that you wanted to talk about, but like those buildings to me were magic. It was a representation, most successful experiment in the history of humankind, like in just there's these two towers. And by being a finance and accounting student in New York City, like I always wanted, like to me, I really wanted to work in the World Trade Center. And I was fortunate enough to get that opportunity. So.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, hearing the story of someone like yourself and your family coming over and finding successes here in the United States and, the area of the country that you're talking, state New York. And, I've been there, a few times myself, and it's really beautiful, area of the country. I can just imagine someone see for the first time, just the, eyes wide open as you're looking out the car window, maybe of, as you're driving by, and it's just like really, an amazing sight to see. And, there's so much more throughout the whole country. That's just a small piece of the country, but, it's such a great, great place. And so I can only imagine someone coming in for the very first time, seeing it, with their own two eyes, but then getting your dream, being able to work in the World Trade Center, that's pretty amazing as well. On 9/11 about the World Trade Center, where were you as far, being in New York and all of that is, I know that that's kind of part of your story.
I think it's, that day became a major, major, like I would say it's a cornerstone, one of the cornerstones. I got to think a lot about it, and I am 100% certain that there was some kind of divine intervention on that day. Because if you listen to the stories of all the survivors, they start like this, but something happened and we were late.
Yeah.
It's an amazing, it's amazing to hear how many people were late. And we studied together for the CPA exam, the Certified Public Accountant exam. And our classes were on the weekends because, you know, we both had school and then we had to work. So we could only do it on the weekends. And I think it was like 8 or 9 months long. So we spent a lot of weekends studying for that exam, like the whole year before graduating. And we became really close friends. And even though he worked in the World Financial Center, which is from the World Trade Center, there was like a tunnel, a bridge to the west side where the water was, and the World Financial Center was just right across the west side highway. And we worked rather and we couldn't meet for more than a year. And on September 10th, we finally met, but his boss kept him late. We started late. We, you know, stayed up late. And then in the morning, he didn't even get up to go for work. And I get up to go to work because I had a lot of things to do. And I remember seeing my boss, you know, like I see my boss going. And my entire life, I always, you know, my dad raised me, he said, so he had this, you know, like kids have some little cycle from their parents. Like my dad gave me this urgency of being on time all the time, and there was no other issue, no other way. And I would run after the bus, and, you know, in New Jersey, like if I don't catch it this stop, I will catch it at the next stop. And, you know, it was like almost like a joke, you know, for me running,
right.
You know, I was chasing that bus. And that day, Scott, the first time ever I didn't run. I mean, like that impulse, like everything wants to run, but your body is not going anywhere. And I'm like, boom. And I remember like, wow, this is so weird. It is so weird that I am not running. Like I couldn't understand, like I got stopped in my tracks. Nothing was going on. I remember there was some kind of lady next to me. Like I look at her, she looks at me, and we look at that bus, and it's like, really, there's no way. Now it's gone. It's gone. And I didn't run for the bus. And in New York City, you can take the subway from any part of the city. You can be in the Bronx, you can be in Brooklyn, you can be in Queens, you can be anywhere in any borough and actually ride and connect without going outside. And at that time, we could ride under the World Trade Center and I would get off. I could actually go from New Jersey, you know, also under the World Trade Center and take the escalator to the elevator. And then, you know, eventually, like I could go from across the city and never go outside and be up in the building above the clouds and not see what's going on, you know, down below. But on that day, I needed the bagel and the coffee. Yeah, I got to get a bagel and the coffee. And I got off on Chambers, which is like, it's the one stop before, but it's like one building
in
block. It's all, there is no divisions. There is no park. It's New York City. It's one long building. And I'm walking up the stairs and I you see people are standing up. Everybody's looking up in the sky. And somebody said, it's a bomb. Said, I saw an airplane. And somebody said something else. In the crowds, you know, like you don't know what is going on. And they just like, I looked up, I remember it was just really light gray smoke. And I thought it must have burned overnight. And it's like, you know, like sometimes you don't even finish the thought. And I hear these sirens, like, I mean, it was just massive. Like it was just like unreal amount of wailing. And I turn around and I see this like, lights down, you know, they're all piling towards the World Trade Center. It's fire trucks, ambulances, and they are just, I mean, we're standing just like one building. And at the rate that we're going, like that was really clear that it's not something that's like, it's major. Mm-hmm. So I look at my phone, my cell phone is dead. I started late, we finished late. I didn't charge my cell phone. I walk across the street. I don't know if you remember, like watching it on TV, like all the cell towers got jammed, payphones got jammed. But
yep.
there was one payphone that was working and there was like a huge line of people. Mm-hmm. So I walk up to the payphone, I give my World Trade Center ID and I show them my ID and I said, look, I got to call home. And they're like, call. So I call home, answering machine, and I say, I don't know what happened. I'm not in the building and I'm not going inside. I'm just watching outside. And I hang up the phone and I go, there was a Starbucks. I walk in the Starbucks and I see the girl. She is just, she cannot stand. She's crying. And I'm like, what's going on? You know? And she couldn't probably knew. I don't know how she knew, but she was crying. And then suddenly, you know, the ground starts shaking. It's like, and outside the window, you see a crowd, you know, like it's like in the movie, people are running and screaming. They're running north away from the, so we were on the north side, mm-hmm. like for somebody who is trying to imagine, I came from the north side. If you look at Manhattan, it's like a pizza pie, wide north and really narrow in the south. And yep. The World Trade Center used to be in the Battery Park City at the very tip of the skinny slice of the pizza. And from that park there, you see the ferries that are going to Statue of Liberty and like you can go to New Jersey, Staten mm-hmm. Island. But I think most listeners would recognize it by the boats that are going to the Statue of Liberty. But we right. are at the very tip. So it's really, you know, it's really compressed, all the traffic, all the cars, all the people, it's super high density. And they hit the buildings from the south side. So we were standing on the north side, we could see the fireball and we could see what was going on the other side, but nobody really saw what was happening. And I had a friend whose mom was a guide. She was guiding people in the 90s. I don't know if you remember in the 90s, they tried blowing up the World Trade Center by driving yep. trucks into the parking.
Yep.
After that, there was no more parking. Yeah. So,
right.
You know, I was thinking like my first thought was like it was 1-2. Well, if there is 1-2, there is always a 3. And what if it worked this time? What if they like planned something massive? And the crowd runs, they scream. Then the strangest thing is that people stop. And everybody turns around and they start walking back. Because if you look at the on the video, so the plane flies in the second building, the fireball goes out, the fireball comes in, and then there is nothing. You know, there is no shaking, there is no, it just after the impact, it is burning up in the really high floors and down below people. I mean, you don't know for a little bit until, you know, I think I left right away, but I remember I watched when people started jumping out the windows. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, you know, there's nothing really to do here because like, what is there to do?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're not going into work at that point. You know,
you're not going into the work and that. You're not going to, definitely you're not getting in the way of people who are running against, you know, because you always see like these little, the firemen and the all the emergency services, they kept coming. You know, they mm-hmm. kept coming. They were going all in. They didn't stop going in until, you know, it was collapsing. They were still going in. And one of the things that I remember is that, you know, like you and I, the staircase in the World Trade Center was so narrow, like you and I would have issues going like, you know, side to side, we would have to.
Sure.
So imagining all these guys going up with all the gear, like it's one way street and people coming down, like what was going on in those staircases? We had guys who got out of our office, you know, we actually had our office, they got out, but I'm saying like, it was watching people who have to go in on the day, you know, when I was not going anywhere near, like for me, because I went to school in New York, I know New York really well. I started walking up north and I was going to New York University was the second largest property holder or real estate after the Catholic Church. So NYU owned a lot of buildings and Stern School of Business undergraduate where I went. Like if you look at it, I think it's 10 stories, 10 story building. but none of the classes are above. They're all down below. So I'm going into the bunker, you know. I grew up during the Afghanistan war. I'm going to find the bunker. They have vending machines, they have payphones, and they have security guards and bathrooms and everything. And you can go three stories down. I mean, it's just like, but by the time I walked there, you know, all the business owners were opening windows, rolling out TVs, all the radios, you know, like people were lowering windows because everybody's walking and you cannot call anyone. There is no Facebook, there is no WhatsApp, there is no cell phone, nothing, just these few pay phones that worked. And I don't know if BlackBerry is still around, but that BlackBerry Messengers was the only thing that was working on that day. I didn't have BlackBerry. None of us had BlackBerries, but you know, by the time I walked, I knew exactly what was going on, and you know, the attacks were finished. You know, all the planes were on the ground. Terror for that day, it stopped. And actually, you know, I watched, you know, the towers to come down. I was already in Washington Square Park, which is, I would say, half an hour walk north from the World Trade Center side.
Okay. Yeah. And I thank you very much for sharing some of this story, because to ask, not only because it's a very significant piece of your life, obviously, because it, you know, anyone who was in Manhattan on that day or even anywhere near there, knows just how significant of that was and experiencing that in real life, not watching it on television has to be a very impactful moment to. I also wanted to ask you about that as someone who was there, because a lot of our listeners, being military veterans, especially over the last 20 some years, they joined the military because of what happened on that day.
Yeah.
And hearing what happened from someone who was there, you know, for me anyways, I served in Afghanistan, so I went there fighting in this war. A lot of other people who have been guest listeners, they've done the same thing.
And your brother?
I know my brother as well. Yeah. And you know, we all went because of what happened then. And then years later, no matter how much people said, oh, we'll never forget, over time, their memory starts to fade a little bit. And especially when we withdrew from Afghanistan, I know a lot of veterans, they did not like the way we withdrew from Afghanistan, not to get political or anything like that, but it kind of felt like what we went over there to do was lost. It was like we went over there for nothing. And I like to bring it back to, why did we do it in the first place? And why were we over there? And 9/11 was obviously a huge piece of that. And this just reminds me of just how important the service and the sacrifices are for everyone who participated in the military, you know, during this time period. And so I thank you very much for that experience that you had. You know, that's definitely not the experience to have lived through, especially knowing that there were probably people that you worked with and that you knew and that you were friends with, or, you know, even just coworkers, you know, that you might have known who time you didn't know whether or not they were in the building or if they were able to make it out safely or not. And, you know, that's just a, you know, scary experience for anybody to have to go through. But I want to kind of go back to what you were talking in the beginning here with the Wings for Heroes, and just kind of ask, like, what made you decide to help out the amputees and the combat veterans who are going through your program, Heroes?
I think you just answered that before you asked the question. No, really, it was the answer. And I think it's end up in situations that change the way we view life, or like that filter, that something, you know, that perception, that something that makes me see, you know, it's like two people are looking at the same thing, seeing completely different things. So I would say this. The Afghanistan war started, you know, the one that Soviet Union got involved in.
Yes.
40 years later, we have 5-year-olds that are growing up at a war that is started by the same mentality, the same geographical center location. But that war now is not in Afghanistan. It's now in the middle of Europe. And Europe is considered the freedom's door because, you know, after World War II, you know, that it stopped, you know, it stopped there. And this time, if when I was a kid, you know, you would have young men, you know, who would get drafted 18, 20, whatever, mostly 18-year-olds, they get sent and then they come back with PTSD, missing limbs, some kind of injuries. There's endless list of them, right? And there was absolutely no system, nothing vacuum complete. They were like coming into the void, you know, it was over. And in exactly the same situation, like half a century from that day. Mm-hmm. And when something repeats like decade after decade after decade in front of your eyes, like in front of my eyes, I left Ukraine first year when it was independent, 1992. I come back 24 years later. I went to the States. I really, you know, one of the things I was talking about, generosity, you know, when people are really generous to you like this, you want to become one of them. You want to be like them. I wanted to be like them. He said I was in upstate New York. I ski jumped, and the more jumps you jump, the better you get. So we started traveling, you know, like Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, all of those states. And I stayed in homes, people who just like other skiers' parents, they took me in, they fed me. I lived in their home. Like I was, you know, just going from family to family. So like to me, I had this clean cut from being an immigrant. I left my past and I came into the United States and I was like, wow, this is so cool. You know, I got kicked out of every grade in school, every single one except the 8th. And then I go to the United States and I was just like, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah.
First, after one full year, you know, I get the letter that I'm a National Honor Society. I'm trying to say like how good the system was for me. I was the same. I didn't do anything. Nothing changed. But really, it's like, you know, it's like if I was a seed in the soil, like the soil that was there before, I could not grow in it. But then I got replanted on the other side of the ocean. You know, somebody put some love, some water, boom, and I flourished. And then, you know, by being in New York, I'm super competitive. I wanted to really get higher in finance and, you know, just like always trying all these things. And September 11th moved me out of the city. You know, I had to go. I went all over. I went to California, Colorado, then Texas. And then 2 years later, 3 years later, I get rehired by American Express. And for 3 years, you know, I was going to different places trying to find my home. And all that was seeing just different the United States. You know, Scott, I think I'm super lucky that I've driven across and I know the States so well. Like I think I just got super lucky with the way everything played out. So when September 11th happened, you know, I was ready to go too. I was close, and I always say I wasn't brave enough to go because this is the best, you know, you don't really need to explain anything. But the emotional impact of what was happening, you know, it was like I remember the next morning we went to the West Side Highway. And for those who do not know New York, again, I'm looking like we are standing by the Hudson River and looking down south, and we're seeing the towers burn, like the only smoke is going at the end of the pizza at the very southern tip. It's just this black smoke going across towards where the Statue of Liberty is. And I am thinking, like, first time in my life, I thought, like, you know, we escaped former Soviet Union because it was not safe there. You know, it was total chaos when it fell apart. And then you're standing, like, I always thought the United States is safe. You know, like for me, it was a fortress. You cannot go to the United States like and do that. you know, it was
sure.
And then like the next day I'm thinking like, you know, everybody's like, in my mind, I was like, wow, like the government really, somebody really messed up to have that happen. Like somebody really, really, and then you feel really violated, you know, like you feel really violated. Like I had somebody break into my house when they lived in Brooklyn, but this was just like a really different thing. So for you watching that on TV, I will tell you why I didn't join, you know, because I had to go to different places and I had to find what I'm going to do. And it was just like these years of trying and starting the business and finding a place where I'm going to be. And actually, because our office was destroyed during mm-hmm. terrorist attack, I classified as a displaced person, and the American Red Cross sent me a check for $15,000 to wow. just get back on my feet. And then, you know, fast forwarding a humanitarian mission, and like the soul of this mission, the inspiration is Henry Dunant, is the guy who started the Red Cross. He was just one guy who was traveling in 1859. He was traveling for business to Italy. He was a Swiss banker. I think he was like in his late 20s, 28 maybe. And okay. he got to a place called Solferino on when they had the battle where it was 150,000 Austro-Hungarian soldiers against 130,000 Italy. I think they were Sardinians or whatever. I called them the Imperial Army because they were French and Italians. And he witnessed the whole battle and said when they were done, there were more than 40,000 dead and wounded in that field, and mm-hmm. nobody was helping.
Oh, wow.
He said not one person was helping. So Henry Dunant organized all the villagers at that time. You know, they were all women because men were fighting the war. And they started pulling people out of that field. And they said that there's some churches had them more than 500 people. And he... You know, he finishes this thing. He goes back to Geneva and he wrote a book that it's called The Memory of Solferino. And that book was so widely received that he was able to start 1 year after it came out. They started the Red Cross. And the following year, they signed the first Geneva Convention. And again, just briefly, Geneva Conventions are important because they are the rules that we... or, you know, people who are countries, the belligerent countries, countries that are fighting through means of force, what you do with prisoners of war and what you do with wounded mm-hmm. soldiers. And before that, nothing like that existed. So, you know, and the first time, I think, like, we signed up. So now this all modified and includes more and more and more. But it was done by one guy, you know, if he looked sure. away. If you didn't write that book, if you didn't start the Red Cross, like, I think humanity in this world would lose out a lot. And like, I know everybody. So first of all, I get help here. And then it was last year, I really had a chance to go around the world and I wanted to see how different countries keep promises to people who defended them at war. Mm-hmm. And one of my stops was the Red Cross Museum in Geneva. Man, it like blew me away. You know, you're like, you walk into this place and when Red Cross is the only organization that is allowed to go in any conflict zone, you know, because they're neutral. Their mm-hmm. Foundation is being neutral, so allowed pretty much anywhere. And they're the only ones. So when they go in, they take these little cards. They're like just little tiny cards and they like, when they find the soldier, they just record name, tag numbers, and then they file these cards. And then somebody writes a letter to the family and they mail that card. So I think one of the most difficult things, am I losing you? Can you hear me?
No. This is actually amazing. I'm just sitting back taking it all in because it's
okay.
It's
because really you're
a great inspiration. Okay. Yeah. No, you're good. Yeah.
So they record the names on these little cards and they file these cards. Mm-hmm. And basically when they come back from the battlefield, somebody writes letters to all the family members. And I think the most difficult thing is having like prisoner of war, POW, MIA in family, because those families, they can never have closure.
Right.
You know, it's never, you've gone through all the stages, right? You have to, but the first thing is, you know, that that person is not coming back. And that's like, it's 100% certain. You don't, people who are waiting, they're waiting forever.
Sure. Yeah.
They can never get to, there cannot be acceptance or grief or anything, denial. It's like, it doesn't exist. So you walk into this, you walk into this basement, Scott, it's like from floor to ceiling, endless cabinets of these little cards.
Oh, wow.
There's more than 6 million names on those little cards. And I'm thinking, like, imagine how many families had closures. Mm-hmm. Just from one, from that room. They get a letter, right, and they're saying, I'm sorry, your son, your daughter, whoever, you know, they're gone. Mm-hmm. And people know. And I'm saying, just by one that thing, and it's like, when I get in, I know you run a foundation in memory of your brother, and you know they're never easy. And like, I, when I hit the wall, man, I think mm-hmm. about Henry Dunant, and I'm thinking like, imagine if that guy stopped. And then they get your book and they say, imagine if this guy didn't write the book.
Sure.
And it's like sure, these little things help us to get through. What I'm trying to say here is that I know that everyone who's listening, like, you have difficult things and issues in life. I think the only way to get through it is actually just by going through it and saying, look, I'm going to go and like, I'm going to get up out of bed, you know, I'm going to do my best. And if getting out of bed is all I can do, man, that's all I can do.
Right. Yeah. And so a second ago, you asked if I was following everything. And honestly, I was just taking it all in, because the way you were telling the story and telling how you, traveled around, went to the museum and all the things, all your inspiration, it was just that in itself was very inspiring to hear how you kind of found your way into all of this. And, you know, in the beginning of what you were saying, it almost sounded like you were apologetic for non-military. And I don't know if that was your intention or not, but that's almost what it sounded like. And,
I'll make myself look as bad as I can, because you guys did made the tough choice and they didn't. And there is no comparison. I just wanted to be, I think it was self-deprecating on purpose.
Okay. Well, you know, I want to say the opposite, though, of what you're saying about yourself. So this is coming from someone who did serve, is that
thank you.
There are people who are needed that aren't necessarily on the ground in combat and fighting. And there was a statistic that I read somewhere, I forget the exact numbers, but it was somewhere like, for every one soldier who was on the ground during the Iraq war, there were 8 soldiers who were not on the ground. They were either back in the United States or they were someplace else doing logistics or, you know, finance or supplies or doing all the other things that needed to be done in order for those people to be able to do that job. Now, granted, those people were in the military as well, but there are a lot of people who are not in the military that the military rely on as well to be able to do their job. You know, the people who make the food, that they package it all up and ship it to the military for them to be able to do, or the people who make the weapons and the bullets and the, you know, all the things that the military need. All of those people are essential. If we don't have those people, then
exactly,
where do those things come from? Right. And more so, you know, there's also the stuff that happened to the fact. So when people come back from combat and they're dealing with, whether it's PTSD or they lost a limb or some other injury or something that they're dealing with, they are in need of some sort of care. And as you were saying, you kind of went around to see how other countries take care of their people who defend them. And in a lot of countries, I've heard from other people from all over the world that they don't take care of their people very well. you know, in certain parts of the world. And we're very fortunate now that we do have people here who actually care about what happens to those people who go off and serve, whether it's from, you know, the Veterans Affairs, you know, the Department of Veterans Affairs, or it's from some other nonprofit organization that is filling a gap where the VA isn't able to accommodate the service members have gone through and the veterans have gone through. And so people like yourself, I feel like are equally as necessary, because there are people coming back who need some sort of support, some sort of, you know, like you're, you know, paragliding and that cliff and you start sailing.
I wanted to ask you, and I wanted to ask you in a sense, like, I'm wondering, you were asking me a question. I had this question for you. You know, you came back from Afghanistan when you found out that your brother was killed. And you're saying you went through a period of time where you were so depressed and you didn't have energy to eat. So, like, my question is, how can I explain to other podcast hosts, to a lot of civilians who are asking me these questions, how can I explain to them that one day everything is fine, like in your case, then you get the news and nothing is fine? Like, how do you, and I read it in the book, you know, there's not much room, I understand, to say it, but I saw that you said, like, it was difficult for you to even function. So how could a perfectly functioning person can go to a dysfunctional person by hearing in news in one? Is that pretty much how it happens in real life and in your life?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. In my life, you know, just for the listeners who maybe aren't familiar with exactly what happened, you know, I found out my brother was killed. I was out on a mission in Afghanistan and found out that he was killed also in Afghanistan. And probably 15 or 20 minutes, exactly the time period, but we got into a firefight ourselves. So in the middle of grieving, I'm sad, I'm crying, I'm a mess, you know, like anyone would be, right? This is just a natural human expression of emotion. And I'm in that position. And then now all of a sudden I have a job to do. I have soldiers I need to lead. I have, you know, people that I need to be in charge of. I'm very angry. I'm not able to grieve anymore. I have to put all that stuff away. And I'm like, I wanted to just kill everybody because I was just so angry at everything that was going on. And then I have to kind of snap out of all of that and focus on the job, focus on the mission. And so I took all of that normal, natural human emotion, that sadness and the grief and all of that. And I shoved it down and I stuffed it away. And I said, you know what, forget about that for now. I need to go focus on my job. And when I did that, I don't think I really understood how to pick up that grief again afterwards. But I held on to the anger and I held on to all those more dysfunctional things, like you were saying, the more dysfunctional stuff that made me be able to function very well when I got back home. And when I got home, I was drinking too much and I was doing all the things that you're not supposed to be doing here. You know, I did it all wrong. And in the back of my head, I said, you know, I'm this strong soldier guy. I'm able to handle just about anything. I can take care of this. I don't need to go talk to somebody to get help or anything like that. And so I just kept dealing with it on my own. It just happened to be that I wasn't dealing with it very well. I was dealing with it in a very hurtful way. I was people around me. I was just not doing a good job. And over time, I kind of just got into bad habits and bad routines, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And I wasn't getting any happier. I wasn't getting any better. I was just getting more and more sad, more upset, and more angry. And it just, all of a sudden, at one point, it kind of blew up. And that's when I said, you know what? Now I've let it go too far, and now I need to get help. And then it was like a slow climb back out of that hole. It was like everything blew up, and I'm at the bottom of this hole of this, where this bomb went off, basically. And I'm trying to climb my way back up. And it's a real slow climb. because the ground's given out underneath me, and it's just not easy. You know, whereas if I did something earlier when I was still standing on solid ground before the bomb blew up, it would have been a lot easier. And so I think a lot of it is, it wasn't just the fact that I lost my brother, because people lose family members, close people to them all the time, and they're able to get back and function, eventually. But I just let that continue, that anger continue to eat me inside, and all the bad things that I had going on, it just continued to beat myself up in my head. And I never did anything to help myself either. And it just made everything so much worse that way. And so I think of, you know, that's a long way to kind of explain that part of it is really just my reaction to what had happened. And I didn't react in a very good way. I reacted in a very poor way and self-destructive way. And I was not doing myself any favors when I came back home and didn't take care of myself or the things that I needed to take care of. I put a lot of my attention to other people in taking care of, my family and my, you know, my parents, all other people. I was focusing my attention on outward, on other people.
Does it work?
It
helps,
at the moment,
right?
I thought it helped. I thought it was helping. But I think what I was doing was I was ignoring my own issues, but focusing on everybody else and thinking that I'm helping. And I probably was. I was probably helping those people to some extent. But at the same time, I was ignoring myself. And they say you can't pour from an empty glass.
Yeah.
You know, so if you have a glass and it's empty, and my glass was empty, it was as dry as it can be, pretty much. And I had nothing left to pour to anybody else. I had poured it all out to everybody already, and I had nothing for me. And I needed to focus on myself and the issues that I was going through. So, you know, that's kind of a long way saying, like, part of my issue was I just didn't take the time and understand that I needed to take the time to take care of myself. Same idea when you're on an air and the flight attendant tells you that you have to put your mask on first if those masks fall down, and then you can help people next to you. It's not that, like, if I had my children to me, not that I wouldn't want to help them. It's just, if I don't put my mask on first,
exactly,
I'm going to pass out, and then won't be able to help
them. Exactly. You can help anybody.
So that was kind of what happened there, is I was focusing on putting my, you know, in this example, I was focused on putting my kids' masks on, never put mine on. And that's the damage that I did to myself. And
for how long?
This was probably close to a year or so. Maybe not quite, but it was long enough. It should have been something I did way sooner, much sooner. I just didn't. It was just me being stubborn. Maybe it was just, you know, any number of reasons you can think of, but it was just,
you know, Scott, I think in grief, it's all on your own clock. You know, you did what you needed to go through internal processes to get there, and everybody's different. Nobody can give you or anybody a schedule on the thing, you know, that's why it's so tough. But I wanted to ask you, like, once you got to the point where you thought, I want to get better and I want to get help, are those resources available to veterans in the United States? So, like, say you're a veteran and you're saying, look, I really need help. You go out, like, where did you go? Like, if somebody's listening, you're saying, I want to start, like, practically, is there a phone number to call, website? Where did you start?
Yeah. So I the first place I went to was a place called the Vet Center, and they are a place for military and people connected to the military to be able to get the help and the resources. The VA is another resource that used. I happen to go to the Vet Center.
I'm sorry, the Vet Centers, from what I understand, they're one of the most underutilized services that are available to veterans.
I believe that. I don't know the exact statistics on that, but it's not as well known as it should be, as far as really should be more well known, and people should use it, you know, all the time. There's a lot of criteria that people need to meet in order to be able to be able to use their service. For me, I happen to meet multiple criteria. A sibling. So anyone in the military, if you're one of your family members had passed away in military service, use their services. Mm-hmm. If you deployed in a combat, I believe you can use their services. If you had other, they have a whole bunch of things. If you meet all these things, you can use their services. And there's a lot of things. So a lot of people are eligible to use their services. It's very, very open to a lot of people. And so it was just really at the time, you know, this was back, before, I mean, internet was still around. There were things that people used on the internet, but it wasn't as common. So I picked up the phone and I made a phone call and made it. It was just something I needed to do. And I probably needed to do earlier. But like you said, it's on my time and when I felt it was necessary, and that's when I did it.
Yeah, you were ready.
And I definitely was ready. And I was ready for, I probably needed it for a long time. I just didn't know I needed it, at that point, So it was difficult, but yeah, so many resources available. And part of the reason why I do this show is to highlight some of the resources that are available that people might not know about. The VA is one that everyone knows about. The Vet Center is another big one that's out there, but there's a lot of nonprofits and other resources out there too that offer services to veterans free of charge. They'll whether it's counseling, whether it's, other kinds of therapy that are not traditional therapy, like sitting with a therapist, but it might be, people who take people to go surfing or to go horseback riding to all those different types of things. And, if you don't know that it's available, you might not even think that's even an option.
Yeah.
And so that's what I like to do. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to have you on the show too. I mean, we kind of went on with your story because I sort of got fascinated with your story and how you got into, what you're doing now. Wings for Heroes, I think, is another one of those resources that exists that, maybe certain people who want to use that might feel like that might be something to help them through whatever they're going through. If they don't know that it exists, they may not even know to look for it. And so this is something that I feel very called to do, is spread the word about organizations like yours and countless other organizations that are out there for people to hear about it. Because maybe the listener who's listening right now, maybe they're not the one who is going to reach out to you and come, use the services that you offer and the type of things that are in your mission, but maybe they know somebody who would, and they can refer them to, hey, I heard about this Wings for Heroes organization, and maybe you want to check, and then they check it out, and then they get the help, through the organization that way. And same thing with all the other organizations that I talk with on this show. I want to raise awareness for all of these great things that people are doing. Because like I was saying before, there are so many other roles that need to be filled in order to have people who went to combat, who did the fighting, who did all that type of work, to be able to come back and function in a normal way. Yeah. And so this type of work that you're doing, and that lots of other people are doing in different ways, maybe, to me, it's just super, because without it, a lot of times they're thinking that they're all alone.
Yeah,
that they have to deal with this.
Exactly, that's one of the things I saw. I saw a huge gap.
Yeah,
and I think you are a perfect example in terms of, like, you use the services, right?
Yeah,
and you needed help before, but there was like a vacuum. There is no way to find out about things. And
right.
I think it's super, what you're doing is super important.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a lot of people who qualify for benefits who can get all the help, but they just don't know how and where to ask.
Yeah. And some people also feel that they, if they do get the benefits away from somebody else, which isn't true. There are resources available for everyone who needs it. They're called earned benefits for a reason. It's like you've earned
them.
So, yeah, it's unfortunate how some people do earn them, especially someone who's lost a limb or their eyesight or, various things that, it's very unfortunate, but there are resources and support available, and there's financial, you know, type benefits as well that allow them to for the things that they had to endure. And so, you know, it's not making them whole again necessarily, but it's helping in a way, you know. And so, you know, I know you take out, you know, you take veterans out, and that you do these trips and you do all this, bring them to, like you said, you know, at the beginning.
Can
of the
we
show,
have a few minutes? Can I just summarize that part?
So
basically, you know what we talked about, like the idea was just to take them as a recreational thing. So mm-hmm. beginning of this season, first we flew our first guy on June 1894. He was 20 years old for 10 days when the war started in Ukraine, and he volunteered. You know, he flew drones and kept writing letters that he wants to be in the assault brigade. Then on the day that he lost his leg, he said his commander went down and he was the closest guy to the commander. And he said he was like super, he was a few meters away, and he gets shot in the leg. And then on my end, when I got here, I had an employee whose son later became a governor.
Okay.
And I called the governor and I said, look, I need a hero who had an amputation because I want to bring him to Turkey. We're going to chill, relax for 1 week. Just, and at the end, we're going to go paragliding. Before he became a governor, he was just a normal guy. And on the weekends, he used to ride quadricycles. It was his sport, like really professional, big ones. You know, they go in the mud, you know, 50, 60 miles an hour. They're really super fast, like these machines. And he stops and he says, Lubin, where are you going? And I'm carrying my paraglider, right? My backpack. I'm going up the huge hill. I said, I'm going to the top. I'm going to fly. He says, come on, I'll fly. I'll drive you up. So he drove me up to the top and he saw me flying off the mountain. So he has the visual. He knows who I am because his dad worked for me. And he saw what we're going to do because he drove me up the hill. And now I'm calling him. I'm saying, look, can you find me an MPT? I want to go paragliding with him. He says, yeah, okay. I know what you're trying to do. I'll find you a normal person because a lot of them are not. And I get a call just like a few weeks later. He's saying, okay, this is where you call. And we have a third assault brigade. They're one of the oldest in Ukraine. And they're really well-funded and supported. When they come back, they really have support, like major support. And I got the phone, the number. They give me a guy. He was a double amputee. And we're waiting for this guy. I'm talking to him, Viber, and writing messages. And he's super excited. And like 8 days before, he gets scheduled for another surgery. He cannot come now. And they find us another guy. And the other guy comes. And that's, you know, a 20-year-old who volunteered. And he actually sent him off. And then we were watching tapes with all the volunteers to got that moment when the primordial brain took over and literally scared them to death too, that he wouldn't remember that he lost the leg. And we thought there was that moment, but for him, it's really awesome. And by the way, on all our logos, it's a number one. It's a real person. It's the guy who we flew the first time. And then I invite him. I said, look, for every opening and closing, you can come. And he came this year for the opening. It was April 9th to 19th. And he actually introduced the first deaf guy who we had. Well, he's completely deaf on one ear. He can hear on the left side, but on the right side, they dropped a grenade from a drone right next to him. He took off his right side and, you know, they completely stitched his ear. And I said, okay, he's going to the beach. You're coming with me to my physical therapist. Let's just go check you out. And we go to my physical therapist. And she just straight, you know, walked down the hallway. And he's walking down the hallway and she's like, oh my God, Lubin, look at his leg. And I'm like, what? Is it just look at his leg? And I'm like, what? When they have a prosthetic leg, all the pressure is always on one leg.
Right.
And our number one is this big, strong guy. He's strong and big. And basically he was standing so much on one leg that his muscles are getting compressed. And they're getting smaller and smaller to the point where they're pressing on his sciatic nerve. And the sciatic nerve is the one that runs from your back all the way down. I think it connects like somewhere in the heel, but it's the longest nerve. And when your muscles are short and they start pressing, what people do is they start kicking leg to the side. So prosthetic is maybe normal, but this one is not normal. And he says, look, he's in critical situation. Like, he is so big and active that he can go like turn the wrong way and he's going to become paralyzed. He's going to become paralyzed. I was thinking like he's, you know, 23 years old. He's missing a leg and he's going to get, I said, what do we need to do? And she said, you have to bring him back for 1 month of intensive therapy. And if we're lucky and he responds and does the work and he responds, he said, maybe we can do it within 1 month. And going back to Ukraine, I was flying to the States because I'm working on doing Recreego. There's a flying side, there's a chair, there's the biggest naval base and 10 different hospitals, like it's all there. So I was going to the States to organize to see when we can do it in the States. And I also want to find veterans to bring them here to Turkey. Because if somebody had an amputation, in their mind and on their list, it says there's a lot of cannots. But if they go across the ocean to a different country and they find the community of people who are waiting for them and they just have a great time and just travel back, but they travel time they come back, there's nobody's going to tell them you cannot do this because you're missing a leg or two because they just went across the ocean and then they came back and they know it. And that is really, you know, the reason Wings for Heroes work and why we're different is that that guy, you know, I took him and they said, okay, you're coming back in May. And I didn't know how I'm going to pay for it. So this is what I did. You know, we were, can you see?
Yes.
So we were on the beach that day. The guy in the red shirts, shorts is the one who is deaf on his right ear. It's 3 years front lines, you know, and they stitched him up and they sent him back out again. He had zero psychological treatments. The guy in the middle is obviously the guy is number one who had to come back. And you can see how big he is, right?
Sure. Yeah. He's huge.
We dug him a hole and he's taller than us. And I went and they printed this card like before I went to the States. And this is basically, I wrote, you know, why we're here. This is not charity. This is a promise kept. You're holding a promise that was kept. And I printed these cards. And then at the end of the next month, number one came back. And we did this 12 one-on-one physical therapy sessions, 8 with a swimming coach. He got back on the bike. One of my friends is a 2-time Olympic cyclist. He went to with the Turkish team to Rio and came. It was like, oh man, we're setting up all these TVs, computers, all the stuff. He's like setting him up. He said, and then one day, like he was trying to do it on the stationary bike. We were outside and he's like, one of the volunteers, just give me the helmet. He puts the helmet on and I was right there. And I'm like, what are you doing? He says, I'm going to ride the bike. And I get my phone and we ride. And it's actually on our, if you look on our Instagram or on media on our page, his first bike ride is there. So,
oh, great.
You know, he can ride. He learned how to swim. He went through physical therapy sessions. He got super fit. He qualified for a $75,000 prosthetic leg. Paid for by the government, you know, he's missing a knee. So he's got that super duper AI, whatever, you know, just give him the knee back. And he became a captain of his soccer team.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So what I'm saying is that I just took one guy and I watched him for more than 1 year. Come back from after the amputation. And oh, by the way, on number one, they didn't do it the right way the first time. He had to go back. After we flew him, he disappeared. And I met his girlfriend and his girlfriend said, look, one of the things you need to know about him is that when things are tough, he just isolates himself. When he was in the hospital, he said, he asked them, please don't come because I need to cry. I need to scream. But you guys are not letting me. So just, he said he, and he, same thing. He disappeared this time. He came back. I said, what is going on? He cannot put his prosthetic leg on. And I said, dude, what's going on? Like, it's okay. You don't need to get frustrated. We're here for you. Nobody is going anywhere. And I said, look, physical therapist, doctor, do you have another appointment? Do you have? No, I don't have another appointment. I have 1 hour free. I said, and he's suffering. I said, why? He said, look, I just had another surgery because they didn't do it. And you called me that I can come for the opening. And 5 days ago, I get this new prosthetic leg and they didn't fit it right. So I'm just really struggling because I just got it five days ago. I really wanted to come. So, you know, Scott, like I could have done this. I could have taken them flying. I could have taken a lot of photographs. And they said, look, here are these guys. They all got, you know, messed up at war and we need blow up Instagram. But they have this trauma about going back. Mm-hmm. Even when they're here, like sometimes they stop and they get really sad and they say like, yeah, but we have to go back. So here's my thought, you know, I want to make this, it works. You know, my results are phenomenal. I want to make it permanent because organizing these events is like trying to send the rocket into space. And like once it gets into orbit, we're not flying it there. We just, let's bring it back and send another one and send another one. The reason I did it by myself and I funded it myself, because I wanted to see how it works. Mm-hmm. And once I saw how it works and once I saw this, what makes it different is that I take an amputee and I watch what they need and I just create it as we go. There is no corporate office, no people who have jobs, who have to fulfill requirements and quotas and get checks and... You know, there's no nothing like that, you know, and I did it all myself to say that one of the most annoying things that people ask me is that, like, Lubin, why do you do this thing? It, like, the government's supposed to do it or the system and everything. Like, what can you do? And I wanted to show that, you know what, actually one person can do a lot. And you showed me that I can do a lot more when I read your book and I said, look, I have to finish mine because, you know what, Scott wrote the book. And then Henry Dunant wrote a book. And then I have a lot to say and I really have to sit down and do it. So thanks to you. You know, we're going to next level. And my next level is that I wanted to be all the time. And I tried on the Ukrainian soldiers because nobody cares about compliance. I'm sorry to say that. But the value of life there and the value of life in the United States is really different. And if I tried to do something like this in the United States, the first thing I need to do is I need to hire lawyers who will give me a list of things that I need to fulfill, insurances that I need to get, policies and procedures, blah, 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 before they will even think about what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to go and explain to a committee, I would like to take an amputee and I would like to go lunch off the cliff. Okay. It's funny, but the thing is that now I'm going back to the States and I'm saying, look, it works. Here are the pictures. These guys, it works. This is how I did. And by the way, it cost me for 1 month, it cost me $4,000 with flights, with housing, with therapy, with swimming, with everything. And that's why I do it here. It's like, it's a place where they can come like home. And I just want them to come and be here. Okay.
Sure.
For as long as they need to, because I have therapy, I have volunteers. I've created the, you know, that camaraderie that you miss. Like you guys are part of a huge unit. Everybody knows what you have to do. Everybody knows, like, I have to do this, 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 and this. Otherwise, I die and everybody else dies.
That's right. Yeah.
And then you go home and then it's like, okay, you can do whatever the heck you want to do. And like, if we all die, nobody will even notice. But your brain is not the same. And your soul is not the same because you were a part of something. And I'm a civilian, but I went through a lot of traumatic experiences in my life. And I decided to do something. And I was just, you know, I think I was picked for this. I didn't pick this. I didn't.
Sure.
I needed to do something else, honestly. I remember sitting, you know, it was April 2024. We had nine Russian drones flew and bombed everything that I spent a long time building. So I clearly knew that I got to go and rebuild my own, right? But if I rebuild my own this time when I have this opportunity, the likelihood that I'll come back and do something in this lifetime, it's like close to zero, you know? So I thought, okay, I'm going to suck this up and I'm going to try and keep going and see how far this experiment can go. It was like that. And just like every day, little by little by little. And now I can go back to the States and tell people, look, yeah, actually one person can do a lot. And all I need to do is like, it's done. I need help scaling it up. So next month I get on the plane and I'm going to Bergen County, New Jersey. And I'm starting at BMWs, just talking to the guys who know, like you, what I'm trying to do and like why, you know, why I'm trying to do it. And the reason why I'm trying to do it is what you asked me before. On September 11th, the view on the world changed for every American, like for all the people in the world, but for Americans more than anybody else. I worked in the World Trade Center. I wanted to go, you know, and retaliate. You went, your brother went, a lot of people went there. And it was just like, you know, watching how we left Afghanistan when you said that, thank you for saying it, because I think it was a big mess, you know, it's like.
Sure.
A lot of people, mostly women, are suffering because the way it was dumped. But it's just this, you know, it keeps repeating. And I've seen it long enough, and I think that I worked hard enough to have an influential voice, not like I don't have millions of followers, okay? But like, I worked out with this guy for 1 month. I know, you know, it was me driving him, scheduling, holding bands, you know, just, I don't go in the pool. That's one thing I do. I don't like pools. They just freak me out. I don't, but I walked by the pool and I watched what the coach did. And I know when the guy is missing a leg, it's really hard to swim straight. Yeah. It's really, you swim like this. But then he started swimming straight. And
well, it's great too. You, like you said before, you don't have a big corporate structure that is telling you what you have to do and how you have to do it and all these things. You're able to try something, see if it works. If it doesn't, okay, well, good. We don't do that anymore. And
we didn't waste somebody money and time. And
that's
one of the biggest things, you know, Scott, like for me, I am a civilian, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I have all four limbs. So what I'm trying to do has nothing to do with me in the sense like, it has nothing to do except I understand that there is war and there is peace and there is a space in between. And in the space, in that space in between, there are men and women who occupy that space. And we have a social contract with those men and women. And it goes like this. You guys go defend us and let us live at peace, pursue our dreams, you know, just do, have our lives. And if anything happens to you when you come back, we take care of you.
That's right.
The end. Okay. There's no, it's the end. But the reality is not like that. You know, there is always something. It's not like that. So.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that too, because, you know, there are many people think, you know, hey, this is not my problem. This is somebody else's problem. And, you know, the government has to do it and other people have to do it. But like you said, you're one person, just like, you know, anybody else. And you could have started the Red Cross, have done, you know, the mission that you're doing now, or you could have done any number of things. You could have done something completely just for yourself and not worried about anybody else. And that would be probably like, you know, 90% of
normal.
The rest of the people.
Yeah, normally, people, especially when you have, you know, when you lose what you work or your entire life, you go in their bill. And I really like, I've done it so many times. And I'm thinking like, I can go and, you know, find my cheese, right?
Yeah.
Or yeah, I can do something meaningful. And I really wanted to try to do something meaningful. I know what I'm giving up. I'm okay with that. I want to, you know, when I'm checking out at my time to go, I'm not going to regret that I did this. The experience that I had by just being with the kid who's like 23 years old, he's a kid. He can be my kid. But like seeing how he is, how he sees the world, like he really has to deal with a lot of issues. And you see him processing it. And you see him, like, again, I have an ideal environment because I fly, and that sport ends when the sun sets. At the sunset, all the pilots land in one place. We all land on the same beach. We have one beach that we are authorized to land, and we land in one place. Then we pack up our gliders and we're sitting looking at the sunset. And imagine now we have 1, 2, 10 NPT veterans that are there watching sunset with us. It's just something cool to do. They want to go kayaking. Let's take them kayaking. They want to go this, do this and this. So it's like it added the community that exists. I gave them a purpose. And they now they do something. And they really like, the guys love it. You know, like everybody really wants to do it. And if you think about Turkey, military is mandatory. They're fighting on the east side, Syria, you know, Kurds, all that stuff. Terrorism is going on for 40 years. They have one of the best soccer amputee teams in the world because this has been going on for so long. So like when veterans come here, like all the Turkish guys, they come and they like get the phone out. They say, hey, look, I was an officer. He's an officer. And I was in the east side and I have a bullet in my back. And it's like just constant. Like they, the awareness, everybody knows where they're from. Everybody knows when the young guy is missing a limb. It's not, you know, it's not a motorcycle there. Accident, especially when you have black and white logos and flags everywhere. Because you know, I'm really big into like showing that it's a unit. You know, I may be one guy, but when they go, I fly paragliders in the summer in Austria. I have these magnets that go on my car, and I just move the car in different spots because you fly in a ski area and traffic comes in the morning this way, and then they go the other way. So I just move my car. And one day one guy comes, he says, oh, wow, this is you. I said, yeah, I see your cars everywhere. But your cars are all over the place. But in any case, it's really cool to create a community where you can come back and feel like, you know, you're more than, not less than.
That's right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, I want to thank you for all the hard work that you do, you know, supporting those veterans and, you know, taking them out on these trips and all the great things that you do. And not just the trips, but also the dedication to making sure that they're being taken care of and getting going the extra mile to do the extra things that they need to, you know, like you said, the physical therapy and the other things that they might need. That's just kind of above and beyond what you originally set out to do, but it's what they need. And so you're doing all those things. So, so I want to thank you for you and for coming on the show. I really do appreciate all the great stuff that you're doing and your story's really, amazing. And like I said, I really was kind of captivated by your story, especially, you know, all the stuff that you were talking about earlier. And, it's just, you know, great. And I'm hopeful that a lot of the listeners were, you know, as captivated as I was in the way, that, you know, even though, they may just be do stuff too. And if they need the help that there are places that they can go and get the help.
I hope so too. You know, it's one of those that I really want to thank you for creating this platform because there are a lot of people who need to hear this. And I know, you know, even if we help one person, it does make a huge difference.
It does.
And I want to thank you for writing the book. I don't know if all your listeners know, but I highly recommend this book. It's amazing.
I
just really,
that.
It inspired me so much that I took action. And I think it's one of the biggest things, Scott, like, it's not a compliment. It actually, I got something that was on my desk for a long, long time. I got it done. And it's like, on Christmas Eve, I finished this, I put it down and I got lost for 1 month.
That's great.
I got lost in finishing my work. And I know that, you know, like what you're doing is just so important. And, you know, you helped me. And I know just because of meeting you and reading your book, I will be able to help more veterans. So I'm thanking you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. And I have no doubt that you will be able to help a lot more people, either through your book or through the do with Wings for Heroes. You're doing a lot of great stuff. So thank you again, Lubin, for coming on. Appreciate you.
Thank you.